Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Pete Musto, John Russell, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Some universities in the United States are canceling their study programs in China and banning travel to the country because of the coronavirus outbreak. The travel restrictions also make it hard to plan for conferences and other university events that researchers from China might attend. That door has been closed for the immediate future, said Michael Schoenfeld. He is vice president for public affairs and government relations at Duke University in the state of North Carolina. U.S. government officials recently recommended that Americans avoid trips to China. Shortly after, many universities announced limits on travel to the country. This includes Duke University. The school has a partnership with Wuhan University, which is at the center of the outbreak. The Duke Kunshan University has shut down until February 24th. Two of the 12 confirmed coronavirus cases in the United States are linked to college campuses. One case was confirmed at Arizona State University. The second was at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. That university says the infected student had recently traveled to Wuhan. The viral outbreak may harm academic ties between the U.S. and China, said Brad Farnsworth. He is a vice president at the American Council on Education. He noted that the 2002 to 2003 SARS outbreak did not really lead to such problems. The whole higher education relationship was not nearly as complex as it is now, Farnsworth said. We have many, many more students going in both directions. The longer the crisis lasts, the deeper the damage will be, he added. China sent more than 369,000 students to the United States during the 2018-2019 school year, more than any other country. The U.S. usually sends more than 11,000 students to China each year. The higher education relationship between the two countries was already being affected by ongoing trade tensions, visa difficulties, and U.S. concerns about security risks of visiting Chinese students. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Hollywood's award season may not show it, but the most popular movies in the United States are increasingly diverse. That is the finding of a report released this week. It comes from the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative at the University of Southern California. The report found that more of 2019's top movies had women or members of racial minorities as lead characters than ever before. Researchers with the university examined the 100 most popular films in North American theaters. They found that 31 movies had leads or co-leads from an underrepresented racial group. That represents an increase of 4 films from 2018 and is nearly 3 times higher than the number 10 years ago. The researchers found similar gains for female lead actors. Of the same 100 films, 43 had female leads or co-leads, an increase of 4 films from 2018 and more than double the amount of female leads in 2007. Other studies released last month showed an increase in the numbers of female directors. The combined research shows that after years of little diversity in front of and behind the camera, the American film industry is making real progress. It still does not completely represent the U.S. population, of which 51% is female and about 40% are people of color. But the California researchers called it a banner year for inclusion. It is clear that Hollywood is taking steps to create more inclusive stories and that those films are connecting with audiences, Stacey L. Smith said in a statement. She established the Inclusion Initiative. But there has been little evidence of those gains yet in Hollywood's awards season, which comes to a close on Sunday with the Academy Awards show. For the 87th time, no female filmmakers received nominations for Best Director. And while the much-nominated Korean film Parasite has made history, only one person of color was nominated for an acting award. That actor is Cynthia Erivo for her part in the movie Harriet. At the British Academy of Film and Television Awards last weekend, only white actors were nominated. The University of Southern California researchers also looked at the major companies which provide films to theaters. Popularity in theaters was an important measure in the study, so they did not include releases from streaming services, including Netflix and Amazon, neither of which provided sales numbers for most of their 2019 releases. Universal led all production studios in the study. It had 9 films with a female lead and 8 films with leads from an underrepresented ethnicity. Universal is the only production company led by a woman, Donna Langley. I'm Pete Musto.
The Fast and the Furious films, a series of car racing movies, often describe a product called NOS, short for nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide is a fuel that racers use to give more power to their cars. Racers push the NOS button on the controls, and their cars suddenly go much faster. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will explore the world of intensifiers, words that increase the power of other words. You might say intensifiers are like the nitrous oxide of the English language. And just like NOS can be useful in a race, understanding intensifiers can help you when you are reading or listening to something in English. Let us begin with a few definitions.
Intensifiers are words that make adjectives and adverbs stronger. Let me give you an example. Imagine a person uses the adjective cool to describe a car, as in,
"That car is cool."
That same person might strengthen or enforce the meaning of cool by using an intensifier, as in,
"That car is so cool."
Common English intensifiers are words such as very, really, and so. Very is probably the most formal, while the word so is probably the least formal. The least formal intensifier, so, will be our subject of discussion today.
The word so has an unusual history. The Online Etymology Dictionary notes that so comes from the Old English term swa. The Google Ngrams search engine shows so appearing as far back as the year 1500, the first year in Google's book records. So has had many meanings over time. We cannot explore all of these today. But as an intensifier, so appears to have been used in the early 1900s, and perhaps even earlier. Then it fell out of everyday usage. A little over 25 or 30 years ago, so, as an intensifier, started to make a comeback. Language experts in England, Canada, and the United States noted and studied its rise in popularity.
Sally Tagliamonte and Chris Roberts looked at the rise of so by using transcripts of the American television show Friends. They found that the usage of so in Friends was similar to other studies of how English speakers used the term. In other words, the language in the TV show was close to the language of real life. What Tagliamonte and Roberts found was that so was fast becoming one of the most common intensifiers in everyday speech throughout North America. It was replacing the word really as the top intensifier. In a separate study, Tagliamonte found that so was by far the most common intensifier in new kinds of written communication, often in text messages. One possible explanation is that so is much faster to type on a computer or other electronic device. It also takes up less space in a message, where space is so important.
You might be wondering why intensifiers are important. Intensifiers are important because they often provide useful information about other words. As we said earlier, intensifiers go with adjectives and adverbs. If you see a sentence with difficult words, you can use your knowledge of intensifiers to predict the meaning of unknown words. Here are two examples. Can you provide the missing words?
That engine is so blank. The car race was so blank to watch.
In both sentences, one word is missing. But you know that because both statements have intensifiers, the missing words are probably adjectives or adverbs. And since both statements appear to offer a description, you can probably predict that the missing words are adjectives. The context of the sentences before and after the statements can tell you if the adjective is either positive or negative in meaning. Imagine one of our example statements went on, as in,
"The car race was so blank to watch. I loved it."
You can tell from the sentence, "I loved it," that the missing adjective is probably positive in meaning. Perhaps the adjective means fun?
The next time you are reading books written in English or listening to English speakers, try to find examples of intensifiers. Keep a record of them and try to use them in your own writing and speaking. But try not to use them too much. Like nos in the Fast and the Furious movies, intensifiers are best used at certain times and for certain reasons. And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11th, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership.
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisers to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again, "Wilson, Wilson, Wilson." The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace, yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now, I have to start all over again. This time, it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.